This is Between the Buttons. I'm Ian Green at Create World in Brisbane, and I'm here talking to Basil Harvey, who is head of the School of Engineering and Design at Southbank Institute of Technology. And Southbank Institute of Technology, Basil, is not just an ordinary TAFE.
No, I think we've spent a long time departing from our old TAFE structure, where this actual institute and the buildings used to be TAFE College, which was very much blue collar. And now we're working towards diplomas, advanced diplomas, very much vocational education and paraprofessionals. And we've also got registration for higher education, where we offer, at the moment, we've got associate degrees, and we're working towards registering more of those.
Okay, but you're not doing the old sort of panel beating and other kind of TAFE stuff. You've got people playing games a lot of the time, judging from your presentation.
Yes, I think we focus pretty heavily today on games development. There's still some trades that do occur here, but predominantly that's in Kotar College of Tourism Hospitality, where we're doing cookery, bakery, patisserie, those sort of things. But what we do here in engineering and design, one of the big areas that we highlighted today with the apples, was definitely games development, and games development for small devices like iPhones, iPods.
Okay, and that area of development is going gangbusters in the professions then? There's plenty of work out there for people who are skilled in that area?
I guess that anyone who reads the press at the moment will see there's been a bit of a depression in the big game markets, but there has been and there is a continuing move to indie, to the independents, and that's becoming much more popular than big game houses. So whilst we've seen the bigger industry players take a few hits, especially in Australia and with parity for the US dollar, I think we're seeing the creep up, and particularly with apps development for small devices, we'll see a lot more independent creators on and taking up a bigger share of that market all the time. And I think we brought up some of those figures in our slides as well.
Mm, yeah, sure. And you've got some very interesting methods for doing this. This is not a place where you have kind of traditional lectures and classrooms with walls and things. In fact, it's sort of a big kind of open space. What goes on in there? How does that work?
Well, even at the moment, Ian, we're sitting in a crit space, which is at the end of every floor in this building. We have a crit space where students can get together with their teachers and discuss things. With the game stuff we were looking at, we work very heavily on social learning, where we work on projects, and it is very much like a complete semester where the students are, as my guys talked earlier about, is they actually interview the students for a job. They work for a job and they work to a means to an end. This whole social learning environment and the campus that we're in now was built around, really around departing away from classrooms with walls, lecture theatres, going out into breakout groups. And so the whole environment is very free-flowing. Students move between classrooms and they can enjoy either staying where they feel comfortable or wandering through another class. It doesn't always work that way. It's not always that tidy. But really, we've almost eliminated the walls which break the boundaries of this is a classroom. And to that end, it's much better if we have like-minded activities running in the same floor. So this floor we're on here is the multimedia floor. And if we've got five multimedia groups going, everything works fairly beautifully because there's no walls there. But as soon as we introduce an English as a second language group who are wanting to do presentations in the middle of that, it can cause a bit of angst. So it's very developmental, but it seems to work fairly well, and our students are very happy.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I imagine there were a few challenges in transiting to this model from the more traditional models. Did your lecturing, teaching staff have to kind of rethink their mindsets, redevelop themselves in some ways? How did you manage that?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most difficult things for traditional classroom teachers and people who've worked in vocational education, teaching in classrooms with walls, and you go in for an activity for 3 hours and come out. Did find it initially difficult, and they had training sessions on how to cope with these environments, on doing alternate deliveries where you had multimodal, where a teacher's no longer doing chalk and talk or doing something then doing an activity, trying to present a lot of different things to students in one go. So the simple answer to the question is, yes, it was difficult for people. We're about 3 or 4 years into this environment now, and I think teachers have got a lot more used to it, and probably more so than other people who come in. For example, I supervise one of my lecturers in one of his educational subjects he was doing at a university earlier on this year. And when I was in the classroom for a while, it looked like complete mayhem and chaos to me for at least the first 15 or 20 minutes, right, yeah, until I really understood that there was a lot of learning happening. So they've obviously adjusted to it a lot better. I've adjusted to the concept, and as soon as it becomes reality and I'm in there, it makes it very different. You're really confronted. It's very confronting.
Yeah, so there'll be a lot of more traditionally oriented teachers sort of listening to this. Well, I hope there's a lot of people generally listening to this, but there'll be people who are thinking, well, you have to stand up in front of a class and teach them something at some stage. Where does the actual teaching take place in this model then?
Well, one of the huge factors that we've got in our favour is the very low teacher-student ratio. So we'll have a teacher with 20 students, and we don't end up having large lectures and then break out into tutorials and then have students working on projects. We do a lot of, it's not necessarily hand-holding, but there's a lot of contact time with the students. So if we bring up concepts, so if, for example, we've got a teacher in an environment teaching programming, for example, for game development, they may come up and go through generic concepts and structures required for coding. And they'll throw them up on a presentation, and then they'll spend a lot of time working one-on-one, encourage students to work with their peers. And the amount of time we spend with students, most of our students have a face-to-face with their teachers for around about 20 to 25 hours a week. So it's fairly intense, but a lot of learning occurs as well as a lot of activity. So it's very hard to distinguish between this is a lecture component and this is an activity component. So it changes the face of it very much. So it's not lecture then tutorials to do the stuff. It's a little bit of lecture, a little bit of tutorial, a little bit of workshop, a little bit of stop and think, and it's very bits and pieces. It is very multimodal, the whole thing.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting. And this ratio that you're enjoying here, is that because you have this particular kind of funding model that you were talking about in your presentation?
I guess our funding has always been, I think we've had the luxury previously because we were always a public provider. And as with most TAFE institutes, when we were a TAFE, you would have had subsidies coming from your state government and also subsidised by the Commonwealth government. And that was fairly traditional, and I think people have still got a concept of TAFE being a very cheap or free option.
Yeah.
It never was, really, but by the time you add the subsidised component onto there and what the students pay as a contribution fee, the cost of delivery is high. We do have a very high cost of delivery. But our delivery and our delivery ratios and our employment regime works very differently from a university. We're not funded for research, and so our teachers have got a very different model. Most of our teachers who do undertake research will be doing it outside of this environment, either supported by the institute or by themselves. So I guess, no, we don't have huge funding compared with our university comparators, but we've got enough funding to support what we do, and we get enough from the Commonwealth government, the state government, to support the learning environment.
And you do have a very interesting partnership type model there?
Yeah, this particular institute is a public-private partnership, and that really means that it's partly owned by the government, partly owned by the by Spotless, and also by, it was created with a group which is called Axiom, which is actually a company set up to manage this place for the next 30 or so years. It's unusual from the point of view that most public-private partnerships are not around educational institutions. Yeah, if governments buy in, they really need some payback. So education isn't traditionally a money-making venture.
Mm.
So I guess from that point of view, it's very interesting, the model and what we do. So even doing something fairly simple here, like changing the shape of a room with a wall or something like that, can be a very costly exercise because it involves the maintenance of that for the next 30 years. So there's some interesting challenges there, but it means we've got a very defined structure on how this place gets maintained for the next 30 years. It must be maintained to this standard. So that partnership is and will be much more valuable as we go into the future.
Yeah, it's an interesting commitment over 30 years, interesting partnership over 30 years, isn't it? We normally think of kind of, you know, bridges and freeways, yeah, tollways being 30 years, or my mortgage, for example, is about the same time length. You're also talking today about the idea of blurring the boundaries between what you're doing and higher education. What did you mean by that?
Okay, I think, as I mentioned in my talk, is we are a non-self-accrediting higher ed provider, so we haven't got the ability to credit ourselves with our own courses. We must get them recognised and accredited by Higher Education Authority, which is the Office of Higher Education in Queensland. Mm-hmm. So because of that and our status there and our status as a statutory authority, a self-governing body, and with the PPP, the ability to offer higher ed courses really blurs the boundary. And I think we're seeing that happen a lot more around Australia, where the Commonwealth Government is pushing us very much towards the fee help structure, mm-hmm, which, yeah, is very different from HECS, where HECS actually is a subsidised model, mm-hmm, whereas a fee help structure is effectively where a student borrows money from the Commonwealth Government and pays it back when they're earning a certain amount.
Yeah.
So it's means tested on that. Our status at the moment gives us the ability to do that. Now, having the ability to do that and then being a higher ed provider means we're blurring the lines, and logically the next thing for us to do, as I believe they've started to do in Victoria, is the educational institutions which were previously the TAFEs, which have become almost like polytechnics, which used to be in the UK and other places, are now going to be vying for HECS places and putting up their hands saying, well, we want a bit of that subsidised model as well. So there is a blurring because of the way that the Commonwealth wishes to fund education. I think we're going to continue to see a blurring of the line between what we've traditionally called higher education and what we've traditionally called vocational, mm-hmm, education and training. So here in the vet sector, so we're already providing the vet sector and higher ed in one institution here. Mm-hmm. Many institutions in New South Wales, Victoria are also providing a dual sector. And I think we are going through a transition period at the moment. I'm not quite sure when that will all be sorted out, but it means that we are definitely moving into that arena of offering higher education. Mm. And when we've got very strong courses like our GAMES programs, and the universities aren't offering a similar course, they're doing lots of gaming and programming, but if we have very targeted either Bachelor of Technologies, Associate Degree programs that both complement students going to finish their bachelor's degrees at the universities and provides people for industry, then it's in our best interest to pursue that arena.
Mm. Yeah. I wonder if there might be some other blurring as well. I'm kind of wondering if some of the universities might be looking at the kind of the teaching model and the, you know, the lack of walls and this kind of multimodal model you've been talking about, and wondering if they might bring in something like that or experiment with something like that as well. Do you think we might see a day where, you know, classical philosophy or medicine was taught in that way?
Most funnily, I think of classical philosophy is generally taught in that way, but it's usually in the pub after lectures. it's the universities have got the capacity to do it. Your sandstone universities do like to stay fairly traditional, but the reason they've got the capacity is because they have got research funding, and most universities with educational departments can experiment, and they can experiment a whole lot better with better funding than we can. So I don't know whether they'll see what was traditionally mode to social learning environments as being a direction to take. But whatever they can do experimentally into the future has to be pursued. And one of the simple things that's going to force that is the following, as we're seeing a lot, especially with iPad, iPod development, where the social networking and the combining and the merging of social network and real networking, like physical networking, is changing the way that our students and clients want to react with us. Now, we have to react to that. If students won't turn up for lectures, and I've seen lots of literature about students not paying attention, or if you've got a wireless turned on, they're more likely to be Googling or Facebooking than paying attention to the lecture because they know they can get that online later on, as with this podcast. So really, the universities are going to be obliged to deliver the medium that their clients are asking for.
Mm.
I don't think we can avoid that, and that will happen. Mm. I think that as less and less people turn up for lectures and want the online version, something will change there. But the universities can respond to that, and they generally have got the means to do that.
Mm. Okay, well, we will wait and see what happens. I've been talking to Basil Harvey, head of the School of Engineering and Design at the South Bank Institute of Technology. It's Ian Green with Between the Buttons.